This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
A red line for us is we start seeing a whole bunch of chemical weapons.
Obama draws the line in the sand. It was laughed at all over the world what happened.
I didn't set a red line. The world set a red line.
There is a determined effort by the Russian Air Force to destroy Aleppo.
They call it barrel bombs. Bomb is a bomb. All bombs are to kill, but it's about how to use it.
أهلين يا عمر.
أيوه معكم.
أهلاً، هاي آدم وياسمين من نيويورك.
تمام. جيد.
Okay. Would you rather we not use your last name؟
عمر تفضل ما نستخدمش اسم يعني لقب العيلة.
لا ما عندي مشكلة.
He's okay using the last name.
Okay, so عمر داود.
You're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. This hour we're going to dive into the problem, well, the catastrophe that's now unfolding in Syria. We'll start in Aleppo, where so much of the horror has been taking place. The New Yorker's Adam Davidson talked with a man named Omar Daoud, who used to work in a paint store, but now works with a group that helps injured survivors of the conflict.
Yeah. Here in America, we hear a lot about Aleppo, but it's very hard for me, and I think for a lot of people here, just to picture what it's like. Where do you live right now? And tell me what is going on near your house right now.
I live in the eastern side of Aleppo that's under siege in the district is called Al-Mashhad. Because of the airstrikes, both the Russian airstrikes and the Assad regime's airstrikes, you can't find a whole building in Halab. All of them are at least partially destroyed. I live on the first floor of the building, but generally across Halab, people tend to only live on the first or the second floor of buildings to avoid airstrikes. We used to live in another district entirely, Salah al-Din, but now it's completely destroyed, so you could say that we're all immigrants from one district to the next. We keep on moving, so we couldn't take a lot of our furniture with us.
I want to know about daily life. Can you tell me what you've eaten? What did you eat today? What did you eat yesterday? And how did you get the food?
With the siege, it's very hard to find most of the basic necessities. Supermarkets are closed. You can't find milk anywhere. There are very few things left, only rice, lentils, and chickpeas. And a lot of this is just, it's the food that's sent with from aid. Usually to get food, there are local councils, and you just go, and each family has a quota. That's how they get their rations of food. And then people just, they go to work, we walk, there's no longer any transportation. As to the water, we get it all from wells, but most families worry that the wells may be contaminated.
So what did you eat today?
Rice and chickpeas.
Well, it's not enough.
That's all we've got.
If stores aren't open, if restaurants aren't open, do you use money? Do you carry money with you?
No, all the shops are completely empty. There is no point in carrying any money. It's completely worthless.
Wow. Money is not part of your life.
Yes, never, yeah.
Are schools open?
Since Russia began the airstrikes, schools have just, they've completely stopped. There's absolutely no playgrounds. There's some playgrounds underground, which are like refuge sort of spots that have become playgrounds, but usually they're very humid, so just people prefer to stay at home. Russia's been using new weapons and different rockets, which completely destroy the buildings. They even destroyed the underground basements where you used to have the schools. Even just 2 days ago, one of the schools that were still operating, it was hit by an airstrike and 16 children died.
How old are your kids?
My daughter, Seba, she's 10. Reda is 6 and Mustafa is 2.
So they just stay at home all day. They don't go out?
It's very hard for me to guarantee their safety outside, so they never leave. Like, even sometimes, if they want to go see their grandparents, I would have to take them myself. They live right next door, but I would take them myself.
Gotcha. Do you have any moments at all where you can have something of a normal life, you know, smoke some shisha or sit and talk or play? Do you laugh at all?
We do try to escape. It's very hard. Usually we can't. But sometimes when the airstrikes are less frequent, we do have a chance to just sit together and just joke and laugh, and I could just get to play with the kids. But it's impossible to go outside. That's absolutely impossible.
That's The New Yorker's Adam Davidson speaking with Omar Dawood in Aleppo, Syria, with the help of Yasmin Al-Sayyad. I'm David Remnick, and this is The New Yorker Radio Hour. Today, we're trying to get our heads around a problem so big, so ugly, it defies comprehension. At this point, there's almost no way to overstate the tragedy that's been unfolding in Syria. But let's rewind for a minute and try to understand how we might have gotten here in the first place. 5 years ago, a series of demonstrations against the Syrian dictatorship, against Bashar al-Assad, seemed like just another chapter in what we once so quaintly called the Arab Spring. And how and why Assad reacted the way he did is rooted in Syria's history. Assad's father, Hafez al-Assad, took control of the country in 1970 and ruled with an absolute iron hand. And in 1982, his regime killed 30,000 people in the city of Hama to destroy a potential uprising there by the Muslim Brotherhood. Like father, like son, that's the key to understanding why we are where we are today. When Bashar al-Assad, a doctor, succeeded his father, he was touted as a reformer. And he was known in the world press as a, quote, mild-mannered ophthalmologist. That was the phrase you always heard. But when demonstrations began during the Arab Spring, Assad acted exactly like his father, as ruthlessly as you can imagine, with torture, with mass shootings, eventually barrel bombs and chemical weapons. Assad's logic is that in a country with every imaginable fault line running through it, Sunni and Shia, Hezbollah and ISIS, the Kurds, the West, Iran, Russia, only he could keep Syria together. And here's the cost as of now. 500,000 dead. 11 million refugees. It's the population of Ohio. It's destabilizing Jordan, Lebanon, Turkey, and the whole European Union with its xenophobic political parties on the rise throughout the continent. While we in the United States have been pretty absorbed with our election, it's not too much to say that the conflict in Syria is shaking the entire globe. To put this in a little more context, I wanted to talk with two colleagues at The New Yorker, Dexter Filkins and Robin Wright, two staff writers for The New Yorker who have for years and years been reporting on wars throughout the Middle East.
I've covered every war, revolution, and uprising in the Middle East since 1973, and this is the first time that I've had to cover a war from the periphery. And to get access is just logistically very difficult, and of course, those who have tried have face dire consequences, including being beheaded.
Because it seems to me this is the first time that journalists can't use their their status as a journalist as a shield, but rather it's the opposite, isn't it, Dexter?
Yeah, it used to be a shield. I'm an American journalist.
When did that stop?
Well, it stopped in the Iraq War. Now it's you're practically asking to be shot. I mean, you can just imagine driving into northern Syria now from, say, the Turkish border, how long would your life expectancy be? Not long. I think the real sad part about that is that because the journalists can't go in there and put a face on all this and show us people, the war has become an abstraction. So it's the most catastrophic event in recent times, maybe 400,000 people dead.
Now, the Obama administration has basically ruled out direct intervention in Syria and seriously has ruled out any military engagement of any scale. And there's a kind of fatalism to that about making the situation better in the long term. Is President Obama right about that?
There were never any great options for the United States, particularly in the aftermath of the intervention in Iraq. The model in Iraq, where we had no-fly zones in the north and the south, don't really work in Syria. Helping the rebels, that was an option. Did you want to arm them? The danger is the rebels themselves have not been very organized. They haven't been very efficient. They haven't put forward a viable political alternative to President Assad. So even though we all wish there was more the United States or the outside world could do, the options have always been very complicated and endangered deeper involvement, boots on the ground, and a bigger deployment in Syria than we had in Iraq or Afghanistan.
So, Robin, you essentially agree with the president. Dexter, do you?
Well, I think what's frustrating about President Obama's approach to Syria has been it's never been a priority for him. It's fair to say when he looks at Syria, he sees Iraq. He sees Baghdad in 2003. If we go in, we are not going to know what we're doing, and we're only going to make it worse. So he's backed out. He stayed away. And so, yes, there's these kind of half-hearted efforts to arm rebels and half-hearted efforts to engage in peace talks. But it's never really gotten the president's full weight behind it. And I think the effect of that has been to open a big vacuum into which the Iranians, the Russians, Hezbollah, every Sunni crazy group that we can think of in the Arab world have rushed in.
Let me just say there's a bigger issue as an undercurrent to all of this, and that is, are the current states in the Middle East something that the United States wants to use its human treasure, its financial capital, its international leverage to try to retain? Syria and Iraq were divided up a century ago by French and British powers. There are arguments that they never really reflected the local realities, the division of power, the tribal alliances, and so forth. Are these frail states, held together by autocrats, dictators, viable long-term? And I think that's a question that Washington has been unwilling to tackle.
So the war in Syria started in a way that was very reminiscent of other Arab revolutions, Arab Spring revolutions. Why did this get to the point where there are nearly 500,000 dead and 11 million refugees?
Well, if you look back to Daraa, where the uprising started, I think that's a pretty good place to start, because the demonstrations against the government began peacefully. People gathered. They protested. Some of them called for an end to Assad's regime. The regime responded brutally. There's a famous anecdote of a young boy who was taken away, tortured, and mutilated, and then his corpse was dumped on the front steps of his family's home. And that's probably the best explanation we have, which is that the middle ground has been taken away. And it very rapidly became a fight to the death, which it is now.
There was no possibility in Assad's mind or means for some kind of accommodation.
Well, Assad, I think, had managed to hang on to power in part by molding together an array of minorities inside Syria, which is one of the richest melting pots in the region. And the rule of thumb is if a dictator can hold on to 30% of the population, he has enough manpower to provide police forces, to man the military. And so he had enough support to deploy a military against the majority, which is Sunni in Syria. And so the dynamics inside Syria were always a little different from the other countries and made it easier, particularly knowing what happened, he knew to move quickly.
It's kind of amazing that the Assad family has persisted this long and that Assad, in this case, has persisted throughout this war. We would have been shocked to know that he would have lasted to 2016, no? It's
pretty remarkable. I mean, I was speaking to somebody very close to the regime just the other day, and he said the secret to Assad's survival has been his intelligence service, that it's everywhere. They're very good. They're ruthless. And they're very good at what they do, and their mission is essentially to hold the country together at all costs.
And how do they do that?
Well, there are multiple intelligence agencies, and they all report at the same time. And You can walk into a hotel in Damascus, and there will be probably agents from four or five different intelligence services all monitoring everything you do. But one of the things that Assad, the Assad dynasty, has always done is use its cousins, its relatives. There is a network of families loyal to Assad. His cousin runs everything from the telecommunications to the Dunkin' Donuts franchise and is also big in the intelligence community. Assad has also done something since the beginning of the war in empowering local figures, local militias, basically. They've become like little warlords. As people have defected from the military, as the numbers have been whether killed off or injured, he's relied increasingly on local forces outside Damascus to hold on to their neighborhoods. And that's been another very important strategy in dominating the areas that he still controls.
I think what's interesting here is if you look at Assad's group, the main group, the Alawites, if he had just had to rely on them and the other minorities, as Robin said, that he'd gathered around him, it's not enough. The regime would have fallen by now were it not for all the foreign players who have rushed into the country, the Russians, the Iranians, Hezbollah. So that now, for instance, with Aleppo, what was Syria's largest city before the war started, now under siege, the manpower for that offensive, it's being sustained by foreigners. It's a terrifying prospect. If you look down the road, where does this end? They must look at themselves and worry whether the Alawites as a group can survive.
Robin, the Pentagon spent about $500 million trying to create a rebel force in Syria, a project which produced about four or five fighters. What went wrong?
One of the great problems was the disparate nature of the opposition. I met with 31 military commanders from Aleppo about 18 months ago, and I was struck by the fact that there was a rivalry among them when they tried to form a united high command, that it would last a week or two, and then one of them would break away and say, no, I'm forming a new high command, and I'm the new leader. And the problem after 5.5 years is also that there's been a great deal of corruption. There is an interest in some ways in perpetuating the conflict because of the warlordism. The aid going in has been ripped off and exploited. It's being sold by some of those who intercept it, some of those who receive it. And there is something about the psychology of war. I saw it during the 15 years of Lebanon civil war, that it went on longer and longer and longer, in part because that's what became the state. That's what became how people got their incomes, how they got their jobs, and how they got their access to power.
Robin, in some sense, the Syrian society increasingly breaking down along tribal or neighborhood lines. How can this be repaired in any way?
I fear we've gone beyond the point that Syria can be reconstituted as it was in the past. There's been, in the background of all this fighting, an enormous amount of ethnic cleansing, groups that have left entirely the areas they inhabited. The mix that was once Syria has separated. And in many ways, the future of this country is going to be decided by outsiders. And the fact that the opposition has not provided a viable political alternative or a viable military alliance to fight the regime effectively. The Russians and the Iranians have both said to the United States, you know, who's the alternative? And the fact is that people in Washington will tell you there isn't one yet.
Dexter, I got to say, I'm thinking about the listener at home, and he or she is in the kitchen or cleaning up, and they're hearing about the various conflicts, the various factions, and it's almost like it's too much to understand and then too much, tragically, to find a way to care about it, much less to do anything about it. And all one wants to know is, how does this end?
Yeah, it's hard to see. I think that if you just take what Robin just laid out, this kaleidoscope of rebel groups, none of whom can get together with each other, this is what the White House sees. I don't want to go too far with this, but I think what we're seeing is a slow realization that probably the Syrian regime will have to stay for a while, if not Assad himself.
What's in it for Russia, Dexter? Why is Russia so invested in backing Assad and doing things like grotesque things, like attacking aid convoys with bombs.
In a way, for Russia, it's they see this through the prism of self-interest, which is they have their own Muslim populations to worry about. There are many Chechens who are fighting in Syria and other parts of Iraq. But I think it's also fair to say that the vacuum left by whether it's the United States or the European Union has created an opening for Putin, and he's seized on it, and I think he sees it as a way for Russia to assert its power.
Syria is the strategic center of the Middle East. It borders all the major players, and whoever controls Syria has enormous leverage on what happens on all of those borders. That's one reason that Putin has such a stake in Syria, despite the costs.
You heard Donald Trump the other night at the debate say that we're admitting hundreds of thousands of refugees from Syria. None of, you know, we don't know who they are, et cetera, et cetera. If only it were true. This is precisely what the White House says. They say the one thing we can do is help refugees. And we're spending more than any other country to do that. We're spending more than $1 billion
a year. So what you're saying, that resettlement in the West, whether it's Europe or the United States, is the only viable option for these people?
Well, they face very dire choices. There are refugee camps, as you've covered, in Jordan. I've seen them in Iraq, in Turkey. They wander the streets of Lebanon, where they're now almost 25% of the population. The choice is, can they find homes someplace overseas? It's a very hot potato issue in Europe. Angela Merkel faces real resistance because she's promised to take in almost 1 million. In the United States, even 10,000 is a very controversial issue. So there aren't many options, even for the refugees who do want to go overseas, who do have skills and may even have a little bit of resources.
Emma Skye, the British diplomat, said to me recently, you can actually imagine that the crisis could bring about the end of the European Union. If the flow of refugees continues, it will put governments like Angela Merkel under increasing pressure. You can actually see the European Union breaking up over this.
Robin Wright, Dexter Filkins, thank you. Reporting inside Syria for foreigners has become deadly business. There's no badge of immunity for reporters. And in a minute, Robin Wright will be back talking with a citizen journalist in Syria, a businessman who took up the cause of covering the conflict, but from the inside. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick, and you're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. Today, we're spending the hour on a difficult but essential mission, trying to understand one of the worst problems in the world, the war in Syria. Rami Jara found himself in Syria at the start of the uprising in 2011. He was raised by Syrian parents in London, and he became a source when he was in Damascus for Western media. He used a pseudonym. He also started posting videos of what he was seeing, and for this, he was tortured by the Assad regime for 3 straight days. When he finally got out, he fled. And across the border in Turkey, he's helped set up a media organization, Ana Press, which files video and radio reports from inside Syria. He himself has even ventured back into Syria at enormous risks.
To the right of this road is where Syrian regime forces are situated, and to the left over there are two areas, Nubul and Zahra, which are where Shiite militias are that are very much supportive of Assad. We have to drive through this road pretty fast. It's heavily bombarded by Russian and Syrian air force. Driving through here at night is impossible because you'd have to drive without your lights on. So we have to head there and back before it's dark.
The New Yorker's Robin Wright spoke with him about his last trip into Syria and the toll that covering the conflict has taken on him.
Hi, Rami. Let me begin by saying how much I envy you. You've done some incredible reporting from inside Aleppo, from inside Syria. Can you describe for us what is involved in reporting inside Syria. I know you're based in Turkey now, but you do come in and you do go in and out. So describe whether it's the historic drama you're reporting on or the personal trauma that you go through to do this reporting.
With all honesty, once you're in and this is, I mean, this is why you said that you envy me. It's because once you're in that area, you really see that there is so much to tell. There are people that are really in need and really want the world to know exactly how they feel. And they don't feel that that is being portrayed. They don't feel that the world really understands what is going on in Syria. If you are able to participate, even contribute just that small percentage in doing so, then it can make someone feel good. And especially someone who feels that they have an obligation, because this isn't really just a conflict that I'm covering. This is something that I'm deeply involved in. And I am. I have many friends and family members that have been killed in this conflict. So it's filling in that gap. It's trying to convince myself that maybe I'm giving something back. But to add to all that, there is the grim side of things, and it is that there is also a situation that I'm very concerned with in Syria, and it is that people are not in their right state of mind. And anyone that's coming from abroad to spend time with people, I think the first thing that you'll feel once you're on Syrian soil is that some things are going to happen in front of you that you are going to see consider as very disturbing or very, you know, awful things. Someone dying in front of you, for example, a child buried under the rubble, and you're not going to see the sort of reaction that you would want to see or you would expect to see, where, you know, you would expect to see the father screaming, going crazy. And that's not what you see. And I found that very shocking, because I kept seeing this every time I went in and I didn't have an explanation for it. And then after I stayed for a while, I realized what it was, because I started to raise the same symptoms. I started to distance myself from my daughter. I started to not want to talk to my daughter. I started to avoid things or blindly just not realize that something had happened. And I think that what this is this sort of defense mechanism that these people have formed, where they, in order to cope with everything that's going on around them, which is ridiculous, because we're talking about what is sometimes up to 100 airstrikes, which is crazy. And it's concentrated on such a small area. But the way that people cope is that they tell themselves subconsciously that I'm going to lose the people I love. And you see this contrast on people's faces. You see people's faces where they look blank, walking down the street, no emotions in their faces. And at first, it creates a situation that distances you from your subjects and doesn't allow you to really relate. But once you understand that, it's really hard to leave that area.
Can you take one of your videos and describe what it was like after an air raid to run out and video it, to talk to people as they were realizing that their children had been killed? Describe what it takes to do some of the reporting. It's not so obvious to people like who haven't been through what you've been through.
There was an incident where we were in a square in central Aleppo. And then suddenly the siren went off, and it was someone in the square that was manually turning this siren. And we saw the plane in the air, and then we saw it launch an attack. So we followed the smoke. We got there about 10 minutes later. When I arrived, it was an old area of Aleppo. So these are really ancient houses, some of which are like 500 years old. And it was about 6 or 7 houses that were totally leveled to the ground. Once we'd made it to the actual rubble, there was about 30 or 40 people that were standing on top of the rubble that were drastically trying to pull the rubble out, because all of those that were standing there had either a sister or a son or a cousin or someone under that rubble. And myself and the person that was with me who was filming, our role and why we were driving in around their car was to cover this. But for the first 10 or 15 minutes of that situation, it was impossible to do so. I felt I felt despicable doing so. We started trying to help, even though we felt useless, because it was even the civil defense, which arrived about 15 minutes after we'd arrived, were not really capable of carrying out these sort of operations where you had this large pile of rubble and people that needed to be rescued within minutes or they would die. And at some stage, there was a man who was looking for his son, and he was screaming, Hassan. And saying to anyone, have you seen my son? And he saw another boy that was wounded, and he was asking the boy, because he knew him, he was his son's friend, and he said, have you seen Hassan? And he said, no, and he was just frantic, he was going crazy. And then it was in fact his two sons and his wife that were all killed because the airstrike landed directly on exactly where they were standing, and they were ripped to pieces. And I'm sorry to be so graphic, to how this sounds, but there was flesh on the electric cords. It was, you could smell it. And once the man found out, he went quiet. He didn't say anything. And this is that situation where there's that no emotion and you don't understand why. And I couldn't cover it. I really couldn't. We filmed something, but it wasn't a report. It was just, it was just a bit of footage of people then digging through the rubble and trying to clear things. And it took 2 or 3 days for us to be able to go back to that same location and to talk to that father. And even then, I think it had just kicked in what had happened to him. He was furious. He was furious. His other son, his youngest was still alive, and he was saying, he was playing with the rubble nearby when we were standing outside his house, and his father kept saying, move away from the rubble. And then the child whispered to me and said that my dad doesn't want me to dig that through that rubble. Doesn't want me near it, but I want him to see mummy and my two brothers so that he can have closure.
Oh my God.
So that's the sort of thing that these children are witnessing. And it makes us feel stupid in the middle of all that, trying to film with your camera. And I know that it's important, and then I regret it later on, but it's in the midst of a situation like that, the people that are there, it annoys them that you have your camera and you're filming them and exposing their lives to the rest of the world. And they've seen nothing from it. They've really seen no benefit from that camera.
So you run a media organization with reporters inside Syria. How do you coordinate them? What are the risks involved? Have you lost any staff members to this conflict?
Yes. If I make it sound all professional and that it's working perfectly fine, I'd be lying. What we do have is people spread out in different cities. We have two reporters in Aleppo, as an example. The journalists that we have in rebel territory are not under any immediate danger from the society around them. So they are able to report freely. They're not oppressed by anyone. The only dangers in those areas are the bombardments, the attacks, the military offensives that are being committed by those from outside Aleppo. So that's the dangers there. In terms of, we had a journalist that was in Raqqa. This was in 2013, October. He was kidnapped at a checkpoint by ISIS. He was kidnapped, and we don't know where he is to this day. His name's Rami Razouk. And we managed to reach out and actually find a talking point to try and negotiate to get him back. And the only thing that they would have accepted was that myself or my partner, who established an oppress, to go and an exchange between us and him. And that it was a very hard decision to make, but it was agreed upon that we couldn't accept that because it would jeopardize all of the work. And we believed that Rami believed in what he was doing. He was someone that was very dedicated. That is a situation that we've been dealing with for the past few years. We don't know of his whereabouts. We have reporters that are also in regime territory. These reporters have to be very, very discreet. They can't do any filming. The only sort of reports that we get from them are written reports. It's because it is the most dangerous environment to work in Syria is really the areas that are controlled by the Syrian regime. Because if you're reporting on anything that they disagree with, then it will be a very ugly ending. And we've seen this happen to thousands of people in Syria, thousands of citizen journalists that have been kidnapped and tortured in Assad's cells. So that is roughly the situation of our reporters across Syria.
Syria has come up in the U.S. presidential election somewhat superficially. One candidate didn't know what Aleppo was, assuming it was some kind of object or acronym. Yes. Another candidate said that Aleppo had already fallen. Do you ever get disheartened by the fact that the outside world doesn't seem to understand Aleppo, doesn't understand the stakes?
It does anger me, and we do feel hopeless at this stage. But I think that the main contribution to there not being the amount of awareness that I assume that people should have on Syria has a lot to do with the fact that there are almost no foreign journalists in Syria. And we do really need a solution in Syria. And I'm trying to be representative, but we really don't want to leave Syria, and we really don't want to be scattered out across the rest of the world. But the main aspiration that Syrians wanted and still want is a free and democratic country. We look at the United States and we see a democracy and we say that that's something that we want. We look at Europe, we say that's something that we want. We look at a neighboring country like Lebanon and we say, you know, that's a step closer to what we want. And we're nowhere near that in Syria.
Thank you, Rami. It's been fascinating to listen to you.
Thank you, Robin.
Hope we get to see each other sometime.
Likewise.
Cheers.
Take care. Bye. This child is injured from the attack. This man is looking for his son. He's looking for his son. They're trying to calm him down. It seems that everyone understands that his children have in fact died and are under the rubble right here. Another Russian airstrike on Aleppo.
Rami Jara reporting from Syria. He was in Gaziantep, Turkey, when he spoke with The New Yorker's Robin Wright. You can find some of his video reports on the war at our website, newyorkerradio.org. Now, you've got to be wondering at this point, what exactly has the United States done in Syria? Could it have done a lot more? And it so happens that President Obama has admitted that he's haunted by Syria, and he wonders all the time what other decisions he could have made. In a minute, I'll put those questions to one of the president's top foreign policy advisors, Ben Rhodes. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around. You're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. This hour, we've been hearing voices from inside Syria and reporters trying to cover the calamity that is taking place there. I've visited refugee camps myself, particularly in northern Jordan, in Zaatari. And what you hear as you go from tent to tent is, why isn't the United States doing more? Why isn't it expending its extraordinary military machine to defend us? That's what refugees say. And that's not just the Syrian view. Whether you're a humanitarian or a Machiavellian in world affairs, you can argue that the United States should do a great deal more, should set up safe zones, should help refugees, should maybe even bomb the airports of Syria. But President Obama ran, after all, largely on his judgment that intervention in Iraq had been a stupid war to prosecute. And he concluded as a result that the United States could not go about fixing other Middle Eastern countries, particularly Syria, and it didn't make sense to attack the Assad regime even after it had crossed the so-called red line and used chemical weapons on its own people. I think one of the best people to understand the administration's thinking on this is Ben Rhodes, President Obama's close foreign policy aide, and I reached him in Washington. Now, Ben, the president has said recently that he is haunted, that's his word, by what he might have done differently in Syria. What does he mean by that?
Well, I think, David, whenever you look at the humanitarian situation in Syria, you can't help but be haunted by the enormous loss of life, the tragic suffering that's been taking place there. I think one of the most frustrating elements of dealing with the situation for the president is that we have spent countless hours reviewing options, trying to think through what we can do to alleviate that humanitarian suffering. And frankly, it is just a challenge that eludes any simple or easy solution. And so, you know, we've turned around every military option, every diplomatic option possible. We've exhausted many of those options. But the fact of the matter is, there's such a complex array of forces at play in Syria that it's difficult to find the set of tools that has succeeded in minimizing both the loss of life and the humanitarian crisis there.
So what you're saying is that something like a no-fly zone is something that you've tested and gamed out, and it seems impossible to do without horrific negative consequences. Am I right?
Yeah. I mean, on the no-fly zone, you know, first of all, that is not something that has ever been recommended by our military, who would have to carry it out. The fact of the matter is it would distract resources from the ongoing counter-ISIL campaign. There's no way to put in place a no-fly zone without directly taking on the Assad regime militarily and taking on, to some extent, their Russian sponsors, given that they are the ones who provide the air defense systems. And frankly, even if you were able to put a no-fly zone over a portion of the country, much of the bombardment of civilians takes place, yes, from air attacks, but also from artillery, from missile launches. So you wouldn't necessarily stop the violence on the ground either. So a no-fly zone might achieve a discrete purpose in a particular area, but it could risk significant escalation without even resolving the underlying conflict that is fueling the violence and the suffering.
Is Syria something that can be put back together again in any way? You now have a situation where the second biggest city for Syrians is the Zaatari refugee camp in Jordan. The casualty count is 500,000, 11 million refugees. What becomes of Syria most likely in any possible resolution? And what role does Assad play and for how long?
Well, on the last question, I think we believe that there has to be a circuit breaker where Assad leaves power, that's necessary for there to be essentially a space for people to come together. And that would include elements of the current government as well as elements of the opposition. Look, I think it's going to be a long-term process to put Syria back together again. Tragically, in the Middle East, we've seen similar instances in places like Lebanon and Iraq where sectarian politics led to extreme violence and then gradually led back towards political resolutions that in both countries are still playing out.
So there's an election November 8th. The odds are, if the polls can be believed, that the dominant favorite is Hillary Clinton. And she's been involved with this issue herself, and none of these things are going to come as a great surprise to her. But what possible thing or complex of things can you advise Hillary Clinton, a new president, on January 20th, where it's concerned Syria? What are the options that are open to her? What are the possibilities? How does she possibly help bring this to a close?
What we would advise, first of all, is continuing to prosecute the counter-ISIL campaign to its conclusion. We could really break the back of ISIL here in the coming months, and I think that should be continued. I think what also should be brought into this equation, David, is that if you're able to do that, you have in eastern Syria a portion of territory where there is an opposition that can consolidate some control of territory. Those are also oppositionists who could be a part of a potential political solution down the line. The last instance I'd use on this is arming the opposition. We have provided support to the opposition. At the same time, we've been measured and deliberate about it because there are elements of the opposition that are extremist. And when you're a U.S. president, the last thing you want to do is provide arms to organizations that might end up attacking you. So the complexity
and the creation of and the creation of fighters for the so-called opposition has led to some tiny number of effective fighters, hasn't it?
Well, what we've seen is it's provided. We've been able to provide the ballast for some of the groups that have been operating in the West. What we've also seen, frankly, in the East is that with U.S. Airstrikes against ISIL, sometimes airdrops of weapons, we've been able to work in a coordinated fashion in ways that exceeded even our expectations. So when Kobani was about to fall, we had essentially an emergency provision of support and arms, but then we were able to push back significantly against ISIL. The fact of the matter is, in other parts of the country, you have a Russian government and an Iranian government that are pouring weapons in as well. And so the ability to simply arm a proxy into supremacy in that environment is not there.
Ben, I've always gotten the sense that part of the political difficulty of the president's position in recent years on Syria is that implicitly he's asking the American people to accept a tragic view of foreign policy and its limitations and of life itself. In other words, we went into Iraq full force, a catastrophe. We went into Libya with a kind of partial force, a catastrophe. Now we're not doing very much at all as a sort of minimalist action in Syria, and it's a catastrophe. And the message that you have to deal with and that the president himself has to deal with is that sometimes a catastrophe is what we have to accept. That's the horror of it, isn't it?
Well, the message is also we have to think very carefully about the use of U.S. military force. Where does it work and where does it not work? Our military can accomplish any mission that we give it in the short term, but the question is what consequences is that going to engender going forward? You know, we get criticized for referencing Iraq frequently, but the fact of the matter is that is not a talking point. That is a reality, that we had 150,000 troops in a neighboring country with a sectarian dynamic, and that didn't stop the killing. That didn't stop a civil war from taking hold there. And, you know, we recently traveled to Laos, where there are still U.S. bombs killing children 40 years after that war. And so we have to recognize that, you know, at a certain point, the use of military force became the test of whether or not you were serious about dealing with a problem. But the fact is, the use of military force isn't always the right tool to reach for in dealing with a problem. And there are not that many examples, frankly, in our post-war history where we have been able to use military force to engineer outcomes in places as complex as Syria.
But now, this is a particularly tough case to make in the American mindset when we speak of American exceptionalism and the biggest and best military force on the planet and in the history of the world. In other words, in the political argument, you hear it in the presidential debate too, it's almost impermissible to make the case for limits.
But limits are essential for America to maintain its leadership. You know, one of the things that I say repeatedly is that without limits, America will put itself out of business as the sole superpower. If you look at history, any understanding of history and what brings superpowers down, it is overreach. And the fact of the matter is, if we continued on the pace of military operations in the Middle East, we would be unable to deal with a rising China, unable to exert our leadership in the Asia Pacific, or to look for opportunities around the world, or to deal with the challenge of climate change effectively. The amount of bandwidth it would take to fully invest in a military intervention in Syria would foreclose our ability to do anything else and would be so resource intensive that it would provide openings to China and Russia and other countries to challenge us in other parts of the world. So that exceptionalism, that leadership is not premised, I think, on the kind of unlimited application of U.S. military force to solve problems. It's about making decisions. And defending ourselves and defending our allies and ensuring the long-term success of our allies and making a difference where we can on a humanitarian basis, our military continues to be unparalleled. That doesn't mean that they can solve every problem in the world, nor should they be called upon to do so.
Ben, thank you very much.
Thanks, David.
Ben Rhodes is assistant to the president and a deputy national security advisor. We're going to close the program today as we began it with a call to a resident of Aleppo, Omar Daoud. He and his wife and three children live under siege in the eastern part of that destroyed city. The New Yorker's Adam Davidson and Yasmin El-Sayad reached him on Skype.
Hello.
Hello. Ahlan, ya Omar. Hi, Adam in New York.
Omar, أنا ياسمين وآدم معاك, سمعنا؟
تمام.
So, Omar, you and I spoke a week ago, and Yasmin told me that since then you had some things happen. Can you tell us what happened yesterday?
تمام, من بارح الساعة بيت العصر بيت عاملين في عملنا.
We were at work as usual, and then around 3 p.m. we got a notification on our phone. We have an app called Zelo that's connected to volunteer watchtowers around the area. And then 15 minutes later, we heard an airplane fly by, and a rocket fell on our building. The top three floor were completely destroyed, and some of the nearby buildings. The windows were also completely destroyed. And then we all ran outside, and only then had we realized it was our building that got hit.
Was anyone hurt?
And only one child who was just passing by the street, he died.
It's, I mean, just to hear that one child dying means it's not such a bad experience is... It's hard to hear.
It's become a daily thing. It's very repetitive.
To see death.
Yeah.
But your kids were not there. They were at home.
Yes, they were home. They were all home.
Was yesterday the closest you've been to, do you think, to dying in an airstrike? Was yesterday the worst?
No, it's not the... I felt closer to death before. A year and a half ago, I was going to the Aleppo countryside with a few colleagues to pick up assistance and medicine for our organization. And the route we were taking was being bombed at the same time. There were four helicopters throwing barrel bombs. It felt like wherever we go, we can't escape. It felt like the helicopters were following us. We were surprised that none of us got hurt. It was just 4 hours of absolute terror. I felt close to death many times. If anything, I feel like I've lived more years than I was meant to. I should have died 6 years ago when the regime was just killing us with bullets while we were protesting. Now it just feels like I've outlived my own life.
Have you thought about leaving?
I never did and I never will. I was born here and I'll die here. You might think I'm exaggerating, but when the revolution happened in 2011, I swore to my friends that I would never betray those who died, and I don't feel like I could. It's our land, it's our houses, it's our homes. My wife completely agreed. We talked about it, and she thinks the same. That said, I do think of my kids and my wife, and I do think of trying to get my family to leave, but I would stay. To be honest, after the world has given up on us and humanity shown its true colors, not just to the people of Aleppo, but to Syrians everywhere, we feel that death is everywhere. If we continue to live this way, we'd most likely die, whether by an airstrike or of starvation.
Your six-year-old has only known this life. Your 10-year-old maybe remembers a little bit before, but probably not much. Do you try and explain to them what life is like outside of a war?
We do talk about what life was like before the war. For example, when we're watching TV and a picture of an ocean or a sea comes up, they usually ask me, "What is this, Dad? What's that sink or basin-looking thing with water in it. There are a lot of things that they don't know. So I talked to them a lot about how life was in Syria before and how that one day after the war is over, I would take them to the sea and we would go and take walks around the streets. I tried to give them hope so that they wouldn't just give up completely on the future.
Omar Daoud in Aleppo, talking with Adam Davidson, with Yasmin Al-Sayed translating. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, and thanks for joining us today. Next week, we're going to take a last look, a blessed last look, at the election of 2016. Till then, have a great week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.